Bible says that sensuality is evil. Phrase is sensual and devilish. And it's important that Christians know what sensuality is and to avoid it. Sensuality is around us everywhere in the media, school, work, everywhere. And a Christian should never be one who promotes sensuality in any way. On the other hand, we must realize that we are sensual beings in the sense that God has wired the human race for purposes of procreation with strong sexual urges, sexual instincts, and so on. And so the question is, especially for the young Christian in this sensual age, how do we survive the stimuli, the rapid fire stimuli that come at us unbidden constantly? John was mentioning to me this morning that they were driving down, I believe, on McLaughlin Avenue past one of these exotic dancer taverns or whatever, and all of the girls, all of the buxom beauties were out there on the highway in their G-strings and bikinis and so on, advertising a car wash, is that right? Yeah, something like that. Get your car washed and all these women drooping all over you and suds and so on, right out there. And how do you avoid that? How do you deal with that? That kind of stimuli. What if you have young boys and your children and so on in the car? We're living in a pagan society in which this stuff comes at us. Not just that kind of really overt sexuality, but human body, human flesh, female form is being pushed at us as never before. I'd like to talk about this today. I know we have discussed this, but this is such a recurring issue that we have to make some pretty strong distinctions between normal urges, what is normal, and within the parameters of what we can coexist with and what we can't. In order to discuss this intelligently, we have to define sensuality. What is sensuality? Now, you can't get very, very excited sensuously about a fir tree or Mount Hood, can you? But God has designed the female body, especially the erogenous parts of the female body, to have a very high potential to raise up in the male hormonal system strong feelings, strong attractions. And so the word sensuality almost begins and ends with the female form. We're not going to include perverted sensuality, the homosexuals and so on, which I can't understand. I find no attraction toward. That's outside of our discussion today. But God has conspired and designed the female form to elicit a strong reaction and curiosity from men. And this is necessary for the survival of the human race. And what sensuality is, to a very large degree, is giving special attention, prominence, or exaggeration to the sexual aspects of female anatomy. And I don't need to tell you what those are, so we'll just continue. Now, I have a certain license as a sculptor and painter and artist who is interested in promoting beauty, to use female anatomy to convey those aesthetic objectives. But I don't have license to unnecessarily stimulate sexual passion, inflame sexual passion through my art. And there's obviously, this is a gray area that overlaps, because what is not sexually exciting to one person in a painting may turn on another person, whatever. And in fact, we gave Aaron a painting of a side view of a female figure in the hand of God. And this is my conception of the sculpting of Eve in the hand of God while Adam is asleep, taking one of his ribs and in his hand creating woman. And some, I'm sure, would find that sensuous. Others would find it novel or aesthetically pleasing or whatever. And to a certain extent, I have to follow my artistic instincts, but I have to constantly, consistently ask myself, am I doing this for purposes of beauty and art, or am I brought into a place where I am emphasizing the sensual? In fact, right now, I'm working on, as you know, on this kiss sculpture, this after the wedding sculpture, in which a man and a woman are in a kiss and an embrace, and her thigh and hip and so on are exposed, but she is covered by a sheet or a fabric or whatever, and it is not at all explicitly sensual, but it has to do with the unification of man and woman and their two bodies in marriage. It's very similar in its own way to Rodin's kiss. So I have peace about this. And there have been people who have tried to tell me that any kind of exposure of anatomy is sin, that Michelangelo sinned in all of his marble sculptures, that, in fact, one lady told me that she would never, never, ever let her child see a Michelangelo sculpture. Where's the dividing line? The dividing line, in my opinion, is this so-called art going over the line and exaggerating or emphasizing in a provocative way female erogenous anatomy in order to get men worked up? And that, regardless of the greatness of the artist, whether it's Titian or Rembrandt or Renoir, if they are involved in that kind of activity, even as great classical artists, then it is sensual. It's borderline. On the other extreme, you have great artists like Botticelli, who, you remember, you know, the Botticelli Venus rising out of the clamshell, that beautiful. Do you realize that art like that very, very narrowly escaped being thrown in the flames? Not by the Catholic Inquisition, not by puritanical monks, but by Botticelli himself, who went through agonies of self-indictment for creating such beauty with the human form. Now, if you do know the painting that I'm talking about, it's this very lithe and lyrical woman, Venus rising out of the sea, and she I believe she's surrounded with several man and a woman or nymphs or whatever, and it's all utterly beautiful, utterly charming, an image for the ages. And it was created by Botticelli as a sincere effort to create beauty, absolutely sincere desire to glorify God through the human form. We know this because Botticelli was an intensely religious person, and his own record of his artistic creation reveals that he was constantly ambivalent, am I sinning by showing the female anatomy? And yet, like as with Michelangelo, who also went through a good deal of similar comments as a Catholic, nevertheless, they pursued an aesthetic ideal. They believed that if God created this beautiful phenomenon called the human figure and even the female figure, then there should be some place in creation for the exaltation of that ideal. And one of the things that bothers me so much about young men today is this lack of idealism toward women. Mm-hmm. Women are viewed almost as as a commodity or just plain flesh that can be exploited and taken advantage of, used and cast away. Now, back in the Middle Ages, there was a feminine ideal in which the knight went out and defended the virtue and the safety of women. This medieval ideal, which has continued throughout the last 1,000 years, in which the arts, painting and sculpture and so on, exalted the feminine ideal. But with the feminist movement, with the degradations, the social degradations of the 20th century, especially with pornography, which is blatantly sensual, in that the whole purpose of it is not beauty, but to arouse, we find that with all this attention upon the female body, a corresponding attention is not given to the idealism and the dignity and the marvel and the wonder of the apex of creation, the greatest thing that was ever designed, which is the female body at her most beautiful. And so what we can't let happen is to let the perversions of this world deprive us of, number one, the great artistic tradition, the idealism of Western art that I'm talking about here today. We can't let us say, well, we can't let our kids look at great art, whatever. We have to hang on really rather jealously to the glory of the Western tradition, even the Western humanist tradition, in its exaltation of man and the beauty of the human form. This started in Athens, really, really started in Athens around 500 BC, when titanic artistic personalities such as Praxiteles, Phidias, and other great, truly great Greek sculptors came on the scene. And they carved the most amazing sculptures right off the bat with hardly any real artistic precedent. The earlier early Greek sculpture, Minoan sculpture, and maybe even Etruscan sculpture over in Rome, was formative and quite wonderful, some of it. But around the time of the great Hellenic Genesis in Athens, the Greeks just busted out at every possible level. Architecture, science even, Aristotle, certainly philosophy, certainly mathematics, geometry, on and on. And their glorification of the human body in their ability to carve marble and to cast bronze was something that is for the ages. And personally, I'm not about to be stripped of my enjoyment of that glorification of the human body that came to us from the Greeks. I love it. Michelangelo, they started digging up some of these marbles in the Renaissance. And Michelangelo was a young man, and he saw some of those archaeological excavations and what they were digging up around Rome. He saw these tremendous male backsides and figures and shoulders and busts that they were digging up. And he said, that's for me. That's something that I want to devote my whole life to adapting that particular perspective on art to the needs of my time. He took off, began again a tradition of marble carving that had been lost a good 1,000 years earlier. And unfortunately, the Christian influence on the Romans, especially with barbarian invasions and in the time of Constantine and so on, Christian influence was not favorable toward this humanistic view of anatomy and so on. But when Michelangelo came along, he took off with that, and he created art for all times, art for the ages. And so this is an important issue. It's an important issue that we have a proper, civilized, educated, and truly Christian appreciation for the difference between the sensual as far as the pornographic and the fleshly is being thrust at us today, and versus the what we are entitled to enjoy as those who appreciate, especially appreciate what God has made. Now, let's just talk briefly about the woman's part in this, since she is the recipient of these gifts from God of attractiveness to males. What does she do with her gifts, her endowments? The woman, the Christian woman especially, has no right to emphasize her sensuality by calling special attention to her body in a way that she knows is going to be arousing to man. Now, the woman's body is usually arousing enough to young men without exaggerating and calling attention through low-cut dresses and short skirts and even tight clothing, emphasizing the inherent sensuality of her body. Does everybody agree on that? If you know what you are wearing is going to turn men on, then don't wear it. That's not your business as a Christian. We'll read a little bit of scripture a little bit later, absolutely laying that down, that is not godly or responsible behavior on the part of a woman. Nor does a godly woman involve herself in activities with her body which emphasize the eroticism of her anatomy. We're talking about sensual dancing and so on, which are calculated in conjunction with sensual music. There are composers of modern music who know how to bring out the most sensual aspects of women as they dance to that music. Beat music, I mean, it can ooze. Nightclub music is just made for women to cooperate with in a sensual way. And of course, a Christian woman is not to be involved in that. Similarly, in the thought life of Christian women do not indulge themselves in sensuous literature, romantic novels, and so on that have a tendency to excite and arouse her own sexual passions, her own sensuality. And of course, this goes for watching movies that are frankly designed to arouse such sensuality. So the issue as far as St. Paul is concerned is that even though some things are permitted to us before God, we have to always ask the question, will this activity become a stumbling block to others? Now, there are people we call prudes in the world, prudish people in the church, who will very, very gladly step forward and tell you that they are being offended by your liberty, especially in the area of art. And I've had that experience many times in the past. That anything that reveals any flesh, they are going to step forward and say, you are in violation of Paul's admonitions forbidding you to offend me and cause me to stumble. Well, that's a question, whether we're really causing them stumbling or whether they are wanting to put you into their own kind of aesthetic straitjacket. That's something that is open to question, open to debate, open to deliberation, without us being sculpted ourselves and made over into their image and their own expectations. See what I'm talking about? It's always been prudes, always been these moralists who want to put you into the same kind of legalism that they are in and who have no aesthetic appreciation, no broader appreciation of the idealism having to do particularly with the human form, female form, etc. And it's true, I will not offend anybody by being consciously sensual, but I do have a right to create in the context of great art of the ages. And again, the great art of the ages can be appropriated and fastened onto by voyeurs and those who want to see eroticism in it. But I do believe that historically, most great art has not stimulated fornication, adultery, the breakup of homes, and so on, because the whole intention of the greatest art having to do with the figure is one of art and aesthetics and beauty rather than the arousing of these passions. That again, what? Sure, Becky.
It seems like there is a need for education, though, about what the artists were intentions. Because if you're not educated, what you see is nudity. You don't see exaltation, you see nudity.
That's right.
Because, like, as kids growing up, you don't go to movies with nudity. You don't want to see a naked person. Mm-hmm. And nudity is, taught as, stay away from nudity.
Yeah.
And then if you come see art, and you don't know what their intentions were, you see nudity.
Yes.
And, as my experience, first going into art, at first was nudity, what I saw.
Yes.
But as you start appreciating art and seeing what their intentions are, then you see the world of art, and you can go through a life drawing class, and it's just art. It's not nudity at all.
That's right.
Naked people in front of you is not naked nudity.
It's not pornography.
But still, you don't go to movies with nudity in it. You don't. Mm-hmm. You have this, premise in your mind about what art is, and there's a line, and you understand.
Yes.
So many people don't understand, and so.
Well, there are people who not only object to portrayal of the unclothed figure in art, they even object to a male doctor looking at a woman in his office for purposes of the good of her health. And I know one lady who has strongly objected to one of my sculptures, a male figure, and she also said she would never, never consider the abomination of going into a doctor's office and letting an unknown male doctor look at her anatomy, you see? And in a way, this is similar to the right of the medical student, isn't it, to look at naked bodies and actually cut them up, cut up naked bodies and dissect them and so on. Back in medieval times, that was considered an abomination. In fact, these people, like Michelangelo, like Leonardo, Da Vinci, and others, they had to bootleg corpses and dissect them by candlelight in secret, because the prudes were dominant, this Inquisition mentality was dominant, but they had to know where the muscles originated and inserted. They had to know the basic skeletal structure. They simply had to know that in order to create beauty. And so it's an interesting combination, because more and more the tendency of the church today is to take safety in law. Say, give us a clear-cut formula here about what is right and wrong. Flesh equals sin. Clothing equals righteousness. How's that for a formula? And just to show how far that can be taken, you got the Muslims overrunning Europe now with their burqas, saying even to see a woman's lips and nose and so on is sin. So they're insisting on burkas, and just this week, the governing body of France voted by a staggering majority to ban burkas in France. And there's only one dissenting vote in the French Parliament. They're sick of these burkas and this puritanical idea that any kind of flesh is going to result in immorality. This is a matter of extremes. And so much of being not only Christian, but being civilized, is finding a happy medium, finding moderation between extremes. And it is necessary to have a certain amount of culture and education to hold back these cut-and-dried formulaic pronouncements by the moralists prohibiting us from literally enjoying the greatest art of the Western Renaissance experience, going all the way back to the Greeks, literally. And what we can't do in the name of Christianity, in the name of morality, is ever move back toward a new medievalism in any kind of a way. Now, there was a certain value in a certain piety, a great deal of piety, in the old Catholic Church and in medievalism and so on. But modern man needs to see us as exemplarizing moderation, culture, refinement, tolerance, and so on as much as we possibly can. Now, the moralist does not appreciate going to art school or going to an art class in college and studying human anatomy and painting and sculpture classes. They say that's wrong, that's obscene, and so on. But anybody who has actually taken a class in college, a life class, a drawing class, a sculpture class, with the purpose of learning to draw, learning to sculpt effectively, you'll find, without exception, that immediately the enormous problems of replicating the human body through line or through clay or whatever are so staggering, so absorbing, that immediately the enormity of this problem pushes aside any sensual thoughts. Even in people of the world, it becomes a very, very difficult problem. The human body is profound and amazing and complicated and subtle and all these kinds of things. And not only that, the medical student finds the same thing. He is immediately immersed in the learning the anatomy, learning the function, all of these kinds of things. And so these are very real. There's a very real dichotomy here between small-minded morality on one hand and the fact that the human body is an amazing, amazing organism, both structurally and as far as aesthetical beauty is concerned. And what I want our group and anyone might be listening to this is to keep the big picture in mind. All right. Now, let's talk about men for a minute.
So the moralists, yes. They don't have an understanding of art first place.
They don't care about art.
Yeah, but I mean, that comes probably from their background, too. I've not the emphasis to appreciate art.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like they're coming at it, you know, to destroy art. They're ignorant. And so all they can see is nudity.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have any realization that it could be something deeper.
That's right.
So,
But there is something deeper.
Yeah.
See, one of the things about civilization is that civilization empowers us to understand on a deeper level than your first impression on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. You begin to appreciate some of the deeper things in life. Great music, great dance, great theater, Shakespeare, great literature. And the truth is, many of these same people who say we're not going to stand for nudity in art, they also don't have any interest in Shakespeare. They don't have any interest in Beethoven. They don't have any interest in Tolstoy. They don't have any interest in these greater things. They basically are fairly simple people who want a simple formulaic explanation about what is right and wrong and what we should do in this life. And there are teachers, there are pastors, there are Bible school authorities who will give them this simple pablum. And let them go that way. God bless them. Let them raise their children in a simplistic, legalistic way. There's going to be complications out of it because life is not simplistic and life cannot be reduced to legalistic formulas. But as far as we are concerned, we are interested in appreciation and explanation of the great cultural advances of civilization over the last couple of millennia. And we are going to say that there are deeper things in life, more profound things, which we must appreciate, and we are going to do our best to educate people accordingly. Yes, Sonia.
There's like two comments. One is that degree art, everything you're saying is true, but there was also art from those time periods which was not great, which clearly was created for titillation.
Of course.
I mean, there's very vulgar, explicit paintings that look like, I mean, they were done in the same style as the great art, but they were not great, that you can see are vulgar and would not classify them that way.
Well, there's a lot of gray areas and gray edges about this.
Yeah.
Francisco Goya painted two paintings. He had the nude Maja and the clothed Maja. Have you seen her in all of her glory? Well, it's getting pretty close to being sensual. And you've got to admit it. There has always been a need for the sexually arousing in art.
Yeah.
It's the most natural thing to do. Is to paint or sculpt the human form for the purposes of sexual titillation. All I'm saying is, despite the gray areas, despite the blatant abuses, for every counterfeit, there's by definition something that's authentic and real. And I'm not about to throw out the real. I'm not about to throw out the authentic, just because of that these great mediums have been abused in times past and are being abused today.
Well, I'd like to ask something. Also, you can tell when the artist's agenda, though, in something. Like, yeah. I've been going to these homosexual websites for the last 5-6 years, and there is a stark difference between those sort of artistic pictures or sculptures or whatever.
Yes.
Versus what you're doing or what the great artists do.
Let me just say for the record, you've been going to them for the purposes of researching for truthteller.org.
Thank you for that clarification. But you can also look into the eyes. You can see their faces and stuff. It's means for arousement.
Yes.
There's a different sort of look to them. It's not for beauty's sake. It's for some sort
Absolutely.
Of perverted pleasure.
Uh-huh.
And that's the same way with pornographic things, too. Yeah. There was this billboard that was put up by somewhere that people started crying foul because it was pornographic in nature, and they had to remove it and everything. But what you mainly saw was their faces, and they were all clothed and everything, but it was still very pornographic substance that they're dealing with.
Yeah. Well, there was a Supreme Court justice who was asked in the question deliberations over what is pornography, and he says, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And again, how do you cut and dry that? How do you make that into a formula? It's these are very real distinctions. Yes, Cheryl.
You've been talking objectively about the subject material, the art, the painting. But isn't it true also that you have to consider the intent of the viewer, and that it is possible for someone to use Michelangelo's great work in a sinful way if they come with an evil intent?
Mm-hmm.
And while that doesn't condemn his art and doesn't outlaw it, there are two halves to this question, aren't there? And
what
could be perfectly innocent and inspiring and uplifting and even God glorifying to one person, to another person could be a sensual.
Let's just ask about God Himself. Maybe God Himself is somewhat to blame for creating Marilyn Monroe. I mean, God put a pretty power-packed package there before the world, didn't He? In every aspect, her face, her lips, her figure, her mannerisms, her baby doll voice, everything like that, to a very large degree. God Himself designed all that.
I'm
just saying.
She.
Yeah, I know she exploited it, but even if Marilyn Monroe were a housewife, she would still have, by the endowment of God, very powerful arousing effects upon men. I think that can be stated, okay? Now, God designed that. God designed all of that. And so why don't we say, well, God, you're halfway to blame here for producing females with a very high erotic potential in them. In fact, an erotic potential that really quite unsuccessfully can be clothed because it's just there. And the fact is that as long as the sculptor or the painter, the filmmaker, whatever, is not going out of his way to emphasize those features and jack up the emotions, just as God is not willfully tempting lusting men, then we have to say that the artist as well as God is morally neutral, morally free from blame, and the onus of exaggerating and lusting has to be in the eye of the beholder.
Right.
The person who has the prurient interest, who has the evil intentions, and so on.
Yeah,
and so it is a two-way thing. But the moralist ultimately could say, God, you never should have created a sensual woman in the first place. You should have made them all with ironing board figures and hatchet-faced women. You know the stereotype, going around with their rolling pins. That's the kind of women you should know about. You should have confined your creative activities in, then very safe, very legalistic, and then we wouldn't have had any sin in the world. Okay? This is by design of God.
It is.
God has literally wired into the male the interest in the female form because of the need for the survival of the species. And women really don't understand that. They think, well, if you figure out what a woman looks like with her clothes off, so what? Why don't you go on with life now that you've solved that particular riddle and go on to more interesting projects and questions? It doesn't work that way. No. You see, do you realize that Abraham, even after Sarah died, do you really know how many wives and how many children he produced at age 140? I mean, that's a powerful, powerful reminder to us that by design, the very greatest patriarch was very interested in women clear past the century mark. And back then, in the post-flood period, there was still evidently a continuance of this longevity of the human species, dating back to the time when they lived 900 years and whatever, and the patriarchs lived 130, 140, 150 years, even after the flood. But the sexual interest of the male toward the female, the curiosity and so on, is there by design of God, so that if your first wife dies, let's say your first wife dies or your second wife dies in childbirth, The man will be there to make sure more people are, more children, more heirs, more family members are produced.
Well, the beauty of this sexuality that God has created us into, and the controls that can control it in Christianity, provide the balance. We have the scripture which says, "No fornicator or adulterer shall see the kingdom of heaven." So consequently, we have a very powerful control that we can apply, the spiritual realization that we cannot fall through in immorality. But the world does not have this control. We see it being totally abused. And it just makes my heart rend when I understand that one out of three of the beautiful little teen girls out there are having sex now. And they don't have this control that keeps them from becoming an animal. But we have this wonderful, beautiful control of judgment, of the knowledge and fear of judgment, if we allow this to go beyond what God has naturally created in us.
All right. Well, this brings us to the concept of sublimation. You see, I've been talking about how God has wired, particularly the male, toward an interest in the female figure and so on. But we are not animals. We are not wired in the sense of being pre-programmed like the beasts of the field to reproduce and mate and so on as automatons. We are also have an extremely powerful force within us, which is our free will, don't we? We are beings also made in the image of God with moral capabilities which can say to the brute in us, to the animal passions in us, "No, get down. Get down. I resist you. I put you down," you see. "No, I'm not going to behave like an animal. I am a being made in the image of God. And not only that, but my regard for the female of the species can be noble, protective, exalting, God glorifying." And so, for that reason, a man with a strong libido, a strong natural procreative instinct, can also be the protector of women. He can be the knight on horseback. He can be the policeman. He can be the legislator holding back child pornography laws or whatever. He can express himself through his demonstrable actions in the highest and most noble way. Now, where an adolescent, maybe an adolescent boy or someone who has not attained to these refinements of character falls short is we go astray, especially before a man is married and has a wife in which he can fulfill himself sexually with. But before a young man has a wife, then he goes astray in letting his free will become lazy and instead allowing his animal desires, animal curiosity, even animal obsession to begin to dominate his mind. Now, as I've said earlier, there's little we can do to preserve ourselves from the world thrusting it itself upon us unbidden. But there is a very great deal a young man, young woman can do to turn down the temperature, to in other words, sublimate and subdue these primitive emotions. A very great deal you can do. You can pull back from opening that Playboy magazine. You can pull back from absorbing yourself in pictures of scantily clad women or whatever. Now, the Bible gives us tremendous encouragement and things that we can do in order to sublimate, to displace these animal emotions. And one of the most powerful things any young man can have in his arsenal of ways of dealing with sexual arousal is to have a correspondingly greater mission and cause in life. Something that, especially before he has his own wife, he is consumed and absorbed with God and promotion of the purposes and the plan and the outreach, the blessings of God for society. And that's why it's so important that a young person, even before they're teenagers, solidly establish a self-conception that says, I have a very strong mission in life. Now, if you're a young person, especially a young person who calls himself a Christian, and I ask you, and I say, what is your mission in your life? And you say, I don't know. I don't know what my mission is like. I don't know what my mission is in life yet, or and so on. If you can't positively, with a ringing voice, say, I know what my mission in life is. But talking about your occupation. No. Occupation is not your mission in life. Your mission in life, from your earliest years, should be to save souls, to speak in defense of God, to glorify God, to bring light to your friends and your classmates and the kids you play with and so on. That just infused me even as early as 8 or 9 years old. And I can't understand how any young person who claims to be a Christian would not have a clear answer. I know what my mission is in life. My mission in life is to save my friends. My mission in life is to defend God and to glorify God and so on. That kind of conviction should be in a young person's heart years before they ever get any clear guidance perhaps on what they're going to be in life as far as an occupation. An occupation is a tent-making activity to sustain you financially, but basically to provide a base of operations so you can radiate out through doing what your real mission is in life. We're all supposed to be missionaries. So this, every young person should have a missionary motive. Now, if you have a strong missionary motive, if you have the love of God in your heart, you are going to have great consideration for women. The rights of women, the privacy of women, the dignity of women, and so on. You are going to respect women. You are not, if you love humanity and love God and want to save people, you are not going to ever view a woman in degrading terms. She is not going to become, I hate to use the word, but she's not going to become a piece of meat to you to be abused. And that's the whole essence of the pornography industry, the flesh industry, you see. Now, what I'd like to do today is just kind of conclude with reading a wonderful sequence of verses in 1 and 2 Timothy, in which Paul is talking to a young man, Timothy, a young man with hormones coursing through his veins, young, strong, virile, and yet, in all of these verses, Paul is telling Timothy, take the high road. Take the road of consecration and service and respect and protection of your moral values in a corrupt ancient world. So let's just go to 1 and 2 Timothy. And what I'd like us to notice in almost all of these passages is the action words there that Paul inserts. These are in the imperative mode in the Greek, which means they're a command. They say, do this. Take action. And let's take in these action words into our lives. And let me just read the definition of sublimation, which I got from the dictionary. Webster's defines sublimation. quote, to express socially unacceptable impulses or biological drives in constructive, socially accepted norms. Okay? It means that you cannot deny or get rid of perhaps these biological drives, but through intelligence, through free will, through culture and education, and through love of humanity, particularly the opposite sex, you are able to put those things down and replace them with higher conduct, higher exemplification of Christian and civilized values. And let's turn to 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 18 and 19. This charge I commit unto thee, son Timothy, according to the prophecies which went before on thee, that thou by them mightest war a good warfare. Already Paul is saying, young Timothy, you're a soldier. You need a mission? You need a life calling? You need a cause? I'm telling you what your cause is. You're in battle right now. You are in battle as a young Christian against tremendous foes from within and from without. You have the agenda is set against you, whether you like it or not. You are in battle, and he says, "I want you to remember all that has gone before in your education and maybe even prophecies from the Bible, from friends about you, encouraging you to believe that great things are in store for you. Don't cast those away, looking horizontally to the flesh and the flesh pots of this world, but remember all that has gone before you to encourage you, strengthening you in this good warfare, holding faith. What he means there is don't do anything that's outside of faith. To the best of your ability, regardless of what is happening in the sensual world around you, try to remember to look up toward God, hold to faith instead of hold to the flesh, and a good conscience. Listen to that ombudsman of your soul, your conscience. The ombudsman in the state legislature is the person there who has been delegated by the people to bring complaints to the government. And our conscience has been delegated by God to tell us the things we don't want to hear about ourselves, about reality, and so on. Listen to your conscience, because it's going to tell you what might be inconvenient, what you don't want to hear. But here's this action word, hold. Hold to your faith. Don't say, I'm going to take a little vacation now from trust in God. I'm going to have a little fantasy trip here in which God is going to be outside of my conscience, in which for a little while it's just going to be me in cyberspace, or me in the media, or me as a peeping Tom or a voyeur or whatever. Don't do that. Hold to your conscience in faith, knowing whatever is not of faith is going to be sin. It says some have not done this. They put away faith and have made shipwreck of their lives. Now let's go over to chapter 2, verses 8 through 15. Now what I'm not wanting to do here is to indict and to smite the conscience of every young man who momentarily responds to or looks at the beautiful girl that walks across the sidewalk in front of him. Some of this thing, we are in this world, but we are not of this world. What we're not wanting to do is to encourage them to believe that they can dwell in a way that pushes away these other responsibilities of respect and faith and so on. You know, if a 34 Ford coupe with a drop front axle and flames on the radiator coming back on the cowling comes tooling down the highway, it is virtually impossible for me not to look at that Ford.
You get my attention real quick.
Okay. Those sensuous Ford fenders. Oh, that mean, snarling grill. That slanted back front windshield and that very sculptural tail end going by me. Oh, man. How can you pass up a 44 to 34 Ford, a 32 Ford going down the road? I mean, it all my sculptural juices just come out. All is uncontained. Okay? Well, let me tell you, God designed all that into a lot of female fuselages. Okay? All right? Okay, I'm not wanting to lay a guilt trip on men, or especially young men, who respond in a visceral way to that. I'm saying here that we do not put away faith, we do not put away perspective, we do not enter into a world of fantasy, a private, hidden world of fantasy, insulated, separated, in secret, in which we pore over and we fantasize and we stimulate ourselves with this. Now, there comes a time in marriage when, in the marriage bed, God has ordained that these lusts and these fantasies be allowed to find fruition. That's what marriage is all about, and it's necessary to do that in order to produce lots of good little Christian children. Okay? All right? That's the place for it. But unless you have reached that point in God's plan for your life, then we're talking about sublimation here, finding other things to do with our emotions and passions which are constructive and which are part of God's mission for our lives. See? And so, what would be kind of the canary in the mine shaft here, the sign that there's danger, is how are you going to respond if I say, do you have a mission in life as a young person? And if you say, oh, let's see, a mission. Do I have a mission? No, that's a danger signal right there. Every young person should be displacing an undue fascination with sex by the fact that he's on fire for God. He or she is seeking first the kingdom of God, seeking first the good and the salvation of humankind. All right, let's turn over to chapter 2, verse 8. I will therefore that men pray everywhere. Okay, here's another action word. Here's what you should do. Pray everywhere, lifting up holy hands without wrath and doubting. In like manner also that women adorn themselves. And this is the passage which is a little bit of a digression here, but describes the demeanor of the godly woman. In like manner also that women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with broided hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array. Now that doesn't mean that a woman cannot wear some jewelry, or cannot braid her hair. It means that she is not to distinguish herself according to those embellishments, as if that is the main thing, her main identity, and so on. Nothing wrong with a certain amount of makeup or anything. There is something wrong with costly array in the sense of extravagance, absolute extravagance, though. But that which becometh women proclaiming, professing godliness with good works. In other words, be adorned with good works. Absolutely embellished, adorned, covered with good works of righteousness, led by faith. And let the woman learn in silence with all subjection. But I suffer not, meaning I do not allow a woman to teach, nor to assert usurp authority over the man, but to be in silence. And again, I do not believe, especially in our age, that this means that a woman cannot give forth opinions in public. This was written in the late Hellenistic period when there was absolutely no education, no public education for women, and it was absolutely necessary for Paul not to let the ultimate social organization, the church, be taken over by women who are primarily preoccupied with the social scene. And he could not allow women, ignorant women, largely ignorant women, to be taking over leadership. Today, many women have their doctorates. Many women are business leaders. Many women even are legislators and so on. And to tell them they are supposed to shut up from any kind of an opinion in public and defer to some educated, uneducated man is just not really intelligent. But the general truth is there, I believe we can say with certainty, that woman is to be deferential toward male authority, whether you're in Congress or whether you're in the church or in education or whatever. Women should not be bossy. They should not be in a position of arrogance and dominance and commanding men and pushing men around. Women should always, regardless of their position or education, recognize that the male in society and in the church stands for God. He is it's a manifestation, a reflection of basically a male deity in heaven.